two different universes, where here you can vary the quantum state and you're just, the reality could stay the same. So, so we don't currently have an ontological model that reproduces all the predictions of quantum theory that's of the sort, but we do have parts of quantum theory that can be reproduced by these sorts of ontological models. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, psi epistemic ontological models for certain fragments of quantum theory. Did anyone happen to see my public lecture? Couple. Okay, so anyways, I mentioned that in the public lecture, so you'll see that in more detail here. So the way that I like to present this stuff is as, so I'm going to not present it as a kind of representation of the part of quantum theory, but I'm going to build it from the ground up. So I'm going to start with a totally classical theory, and it's a statistical theory, which means it doesn't just describe the classical ontic states and how they evolve, but also probability distributions over those ontic states and how those probability distributions evolve when you let the thing go or when you do measurements on it. So that's a totally classical thing. But I'm going to add, relative to that, a fundamental restriction on what kinds of statistical distributions are allowed. And I'll show that from that you get a large part of quantum theory. So you get one of these fragments of quantum theory, and it's a large part of quantum theory in the sense that when you look at the kind of phenomena that exist in those fragments of quantum theory, it has all the usual suspects on the list, all the sort of phenomena that we usually talk about as being distinctively quantum. Not all, but many. So that's the idea. Okay, so you can do this in a few different regimes. So you can take, for example, the theory of mechanics, so particles in whatever dimension of space you like. Now, if you ask what is the statistical theory for that classical theory, the answer is what people sometimes call Liouville mechanics. So this is the theory of how probability distributions or over the phase space of a particle evolve, for example, when the particle evolves freely. And how do those probability distributions evolve if I come in and do a measurement of the particle? Things like that. That's this theory. And then the theory we're going to consider, which I'd like to call epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics, is just the one where you come in and you add a fundamental restriction on how much you can know, and I'll tell you the details of that. And the point is that if you do this, you can prove that this is precisely equal to a particular part of quantum theory applied to particles. That's what I mean by quantum mechanics here. And that's the one called Gaussian quantum mechanics, which has only wave functions in it that have Gaussian profiles. I'll say a little bit about more about that, how to define that theory later on. So that's the pattern. So another place you can consider this is if you start with classical theory where your systems are just two-level systems, so bits, what computer scientists would just call bits. They can only be 0 or 1. You can still have a collection of them. So I can think of these things as a circuit, right? It's just a classical circuit. I have these bits. And then dynamics could correspond to putting gates in that circuit. So these two bits are coupled by a C-naught gate, for example, and this bit undergoes a not gate. So think of that as, it's not usually what we think of as physicists, but that's a kind of theory of the world. It's very simple systems. And now you can ask, well, what about the statistical theory of that? So now I could just say, well, suppose I don't know exactly what the initial string value is, but I have some probability distribution over the possible initial strings, values of the bits, and I want to know how that probability distribution evolves as I propagate through various gates, and as I, for instance, do measurements on some of these bits. That would be this theory. And the theory we're going to talk about is one wherein you have that, but you've imposed a certain restriction on how much you can know about this sequence of bits. And it turns out that here, unlike here, you don't get a precise equality with a part of quantum theory, but you get something that's isomorphic in some sense to what's called the stabilizer theory for qubits. So it's a slight distortion relative to what we see quantum mechanically. But this stabilizer theory for qubits is, I don't know if you've seen this in quantum information courses thus far. You have?
See it, like, next week.
Oh, you will see it. Okay, very good. So you'll see more about this, but it's what's used a lot in quantum error correction and quantum information theory. I'll say a little bit about it as well. So that's the pattern. You can work this out for three-level systems, and then over here you do get a precise equality. So there's also a stabilizer theory for the Q-trits, and this theory that we're defining becomes precisely equal. You can do the same trick for fields, like a scalar field in optics. There's something called statistical optics. And then if you add this restriction, you get precisely what's called linear quantum optics, which is what you would do in the lab if all, you know, it includes a huge amount of quantum optics in the sense that most quantum optics experiments involve beam splitters, phase shifters, squeezers, homodyne measurements. All that is in here in this theory. So everything in those kinds of experiments can be understood in this classical way that I'm about to outline. All right. So all I'm going to tell you about is something concerning the first theory and something concerning the second theory. And I don't want to give you all the details because that would take too long. My goal here is to kind of give you a flavor for how this psi epistemic approach can make sense of some of the mysterious quantum phenomena that we're familiar with. So the goal is to just give you a sense of how this provides a particularly natural interpretation of formalism if it can be made to work. All right, so we'll start with this epistemically restricted legal mechanics. So the idea is that if you have, say, a single particle in one dimension, its ontic state space is just a phase space, position and momentum. Any epistemic state is described as a probability distribution over that phase space. So what we want is a postulate that tells me which kinds of probability distributions are allowed. I want a constraint that says you can't know everything so that you're restricted in the shapes of these probability distributions. So to try to motivate the restriction that we do use, let me remind you of a fact about quantum theory, which is just the uncertainty principle in a form which is referred to as the Schrodinger-Robertson form. So it's got the familiar stuff in it. So this is just the variance in position. So these are expectation values relative to some quantum state rho. So I just compute the expectation value of x squared minus the expectation value of x all squared. And similarly with this guy, that's just the variance in the momentum. And then there's this, which is the cross-correlation between position and momentum. It's also computed relative to the quantum state rho. And so if I move this to the right-hand side of the inequality, then it's clear that the product of the variances will be greater than or equal to h bar over 2 squared, right? Because that cross-correlation is always positive. But this is actually a better inequality because it's tight. I can, you know, sometimes I can't saturate the inequality that we're familiar with this term here, but I can always saturate the one that has this cross-correlation term. Okay, so the point here is that this is a constraint on the expectation values of various measurements I can do, where expectations are defined in the usual quantum way. And so we use that to motivate a different kind of uncertainty principle. So over on this side here, there's no quantum mechanics. We're just talking about a classical theory now. So there's no operators, no vectors, no Hilbert space, nothing. We just have some probability distribution over phase space. But we still have a notion of the variance in position. This is now defined in this way, but the expectation values are classical expectation values. So if I give you a function over position and momentum, and I say, what's the expectation value of that function if your knowledge is represented by distribution mu, you just take the integral over x and p of that function on that distribution. Okay, so that's a standard statistical expectation value for a classical theory. So I can define a variance in position that would be, in this picture, you know, roughly the width of this distribution. A variance in momentum will be the width that way. And this cross-correlation term tells me something, again, about how position and momentum are correlated. So if this distribution somehow, you know, wasn't just a product of a distribution on x and a distribution on p, but something that maybe spread out along a diagonal, then it would have a non-zero value for this cross-correlation. So I can just say, let's assume that this is true, okay, as an axiom. That would say, okay, well, you can't have distributions that are too narrow because then it wouldn't satisfy this constraint. Is that clear? Yeah?
Why don't we talk about this cross-correlation when we first learn about uncertainty principle?
It's a good question why the undergraduate textbooks don't just give you the more sophisticated version. I don't know the answer to that. I think there are some textbooks that deal with this, but there's another form that refers to multiple particles, and that you really don't see in the textbooks. and then, but yeah, I guess it's just to keep it simple, but this is the one that's strict. Perhaps it's because, you know, in many examples, people don't consider the case where position momentum are correlated at all. So if this thing has the value zero, then the original inequality can be tight. Good. So some what is the epistemic restriction I'm going to assume? So this is a postulate, and we're going to build up from here. So I'm just going to call it the classical uncertainty principle. And in this case, it's for a single particle in 1D. And the idea is that the only probability distributions that can be prepared are the ones that satisfy this constraint. And then there's an extra constraint, which is that and they have to have maximal entropy for a given set of second order moments. So there are a lot of probability distributions that satisfy this constraint that don't range over an area of phase space much greater than H bar, but they can all have different shapes. I could have like a top hat distribution that satisfy that constraint, a Gaussian distribution that satisfies that constraint, all these possibilities. And of those, we're just gonna take the ones that have maximum entropy. And that you can prove picks out just the Gaussian distributions. So the top hat distributions are out because for the given variances in position and momentum and the cross correlations, they don't maximize the entropy. The Gaussian distributions do. Okay, so that's how you define this theory for a single particle. And so in particular, these are all valid distributions. They satisfy this restriction. So this is just the one where you might imagine that the variance in position and the variance in momentum is equal if you measure them in the same units where you use h bar as the conversion factor. But I could also have a distribution that's squeezed in position and spread out in momentum, because that will also satisfy the uncertainty relation. It'll spread out this area. You can also squeeze in momentum and spread out in position. And of course, you can rotate it in the phase space. And so this is one of the cases where that cross-correlation term is going to be non-zero. These are all possibilities that satisfy that uncertainty relation. And furthermore, you could even continue squeezing to the limit where you've squeezed infinitely in X and you've smeared it out infinitely in P. So now it's uniform in P and infinitely squeezed in X. And this is what would correspond quantum mechanically to a position eigenstate, where you have complete knowledge of position and no knowledge of momentum. Or you can have complete knowledge of momentum and no knowledge of position, or you could have complete knowledge of some linear combination of position and momentum, which would be this guy here. In quantum optics, people tend to call these things coherent states and these guys squeeze states, where the squeezing is along some axis. So there's going to be, all of these distributions are going to be associated with particular coherent or squeeze states in the quantum formalism. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit about how this connects with the quantum formalism. So I know you saw the Wigner representation in one of the tutorial questions. Have you seen it in your other courses? Or this first time you've come across it? Probably this is the first time. Okay. You've heard about it, but haven't seen it. Okay. So I won't tell you that much, but you can define a set of operators. Okay, so these operators are parameterized by position and momentum. This is a Hermitian operator. It's got this strange definition, which isn't going to be very important. The important thing is that this set of operators forms a complete basis for the space of operators on the system. So any operator you give me for this system, I can write it as an integral over x and p of some function of x and p times this operator, right? So just some linear combination of these operators. And so in particular, if you give me any operator O, if I compute the inner product of O with this phase point operator, so remember, trace of, you know, A times B is a kind of inner product in the space of Hermitian operators. It's called the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. And just like I can represent any vector, if you give me its components relative to some complete basis of vectors, given that these A's are a complete basis of vectors for the vector space of Hermitian operators, I can represent any operator O just by giving you its components relative to that basis. So that's what this function is. It's just all the components of O relative to this basis of phase point operators. So I know, because these things are a complete basis, that this will represent, this will have all the information about O in it. But now it's a function on phase space. So it's a lot more like those probability distributions we were seeing. What you can show is that if the operator O that you're interested in is itself Hermitian, then because these A's are Hermitian operators, then trace of O times A is just some linear combination of real numbers, so this function is a real function. Okay, so not only is it a function on phase space, it's a real valued function on phase space. Good. So and another thing you can verify is that if you have an operator, like a density operator, whose trace is 1, then you can prove that that corresponds to its, so these are called, this is called the Wigner function of the operator O. So the Wigner function of the density operator rho is normalized, right? If I integrate over the phase space, I get 1. And let's see, so to see that, it suffices for you to know that, like if I were to integrate this guy over x and p, where O is equal to rho, I pull the integral inside. It turns out that the integral of these phase point operators over x and p is just the identity operator, and that's how you get this here. So again, it's like a probability distribution over phase space in the sense that it's normalized to 1. Furthermore, if you give me a positive operator valued measure, so a set of positive operators that sum to identity, these could, for example, be projectors, then we represent each one of these guys as its Wigner function multiplied by 2 pi h bar. So that's just to make sure that all the normalizations come out right. And it turns out that you can prove that if these guys sum to identity, then the sums of their Wigner functions multiplied by that factor give me 1, which is, again, what you would expect if these were classical conditional probabilities. If this was the probability of getting outcome k in the measurement, given that the ontic state of the particle was x and p, then I would have expected that if I just summed over the different outcomes k, I would get 1. Of course, I should say if 2 pi h bar times this were the conditional probability, I should get 1. So, all right. So it has all these features in common with a probabilistic phase-based representation. And then finally, if I classically ask what would the expression be for the overall probability of outcome k, I would have multiplied the probability of outcome k given that the ontic state is x and p with the probability that the ontic state is x and p given that the preparation was rho and integrated. And sure enough, in the Wigner representation, that does reproduce the Born probability, which is the probability of getting outcome k given that you prepared rho. So this all looks good, except for the fact that it's just real. It's not necessarily positive. Okay, so what you'll find is that for certain kinds of quantum states, their Wigner function is not everywhere positive. For certain kinds of POVMs, their Wigner representation doesn't correspond to a positive conditional probability. And so I can't simply interpret this classically in the general case. I should mention also that if you want to consider transformations, so if you have completely positive trace-preserving map E, then that also has a representation in the Wigner formalism, which is, it looks like a conditional probability. So if this were all classical, I might have expected that I should specify the probability of landing in the ontic state x prime p prime, given that the initial ontic state was x and p. Here you just define a real valued conditional, where you take the phase point operators here, labeled by x and p, act the map on them, and then take the inner product with the phase point operator x prime p prime. And you can show, for example, that the Wigner function of the evolute of rho under that map is just, the Wigner function of rho multiplied by this Wigner conditional integrated over x prime and p prime. So it looks like what you would have expected if this was all classical probabilities, except that these guys aren't necessarily positive. It turns out that these distributions that I told you about earlier, the ones that satisfy this postulate I set out, the epistemic restriction, are precisely the Wigner representations of the squeeze states. Okay, so I can define a set of quantum states, and then when I work out their Wigner representation, it turns out that they're nowhere negative. They're positive everywhere, they have Gaussian profiles, and they look like this. So these guys are a subset of the valid quantum states. And what you find in general is that Okay, so here I've just drawn all the functions on phase space. If I look at the functions on phase space that are Wigner functions for some valid quantum state, that's this part of the Venn diagram here. And there are some that correspond to Gaussian states, that's this region, and some that correspond to non-Gaussian states. And that just means that their Wigner functions are actually of Gaussian form. That's another way of defining it. So a Gaussian quantum state is by definition just one whose Wigner function is Gaussian in all the coordinates. And then what I was talking about earlier in terms of probability distributions on phase space, I can define lots of probability distributions on phase space that don't satisfy this epistemic restriction I told you about, the one with the uncertainty relation, and I can find all the ones that do satisfy it, and that's this distinction. And it turns out that this is where you have the coincidence, that the Wigner functions of Gaussian quantum states are exactly the probability distributions that satisfy the epistemic restriction. So when you add the restriction and you get down to here, you recover this fragment of quantum theory that I called Gaussian quantum mechanics. All right, I need to tell you a little bit more about the theory. I haven't told you anything about, so this is the classical theory that I'm defining in terms of the postulate. I didn't tell you what the valid transformations were. I just said, here's what the valid probability distributions are. And it turns out if you define the transformations to be the canonical transformations, and by that I mean in the sense of classical mechanics, the ones that preserve the Poisson bracket, that preserve the symplectic structure, but whose classical Hamiltonians are quadratic in position momentum only, that subset of canonical transformations, then you find that they will preserve that epistemic restriction being satisfied. So if the initial distribution satisfies the restriction, then under this kind of deterministic evolution, the final distribution will as well. And the proof of that is simply that if you look at any canonical transformation for any Hamiltonian, you find that the uncertainty principle that I wrote down is satisfied. Okay, so you can prove that that thing is preserved by classically by any canonical transformation. And you know that should remind you of Liouville's theorem. But to preserve the maximum entropy condition, the fact that these guys have to be Gaussians, that's what tells me that the Hamiltonians have to be quadratic. If they're not quadratic, then I can evolve from a Gaussian distribution to a non-Gaussian one. Okay, so among these valid transformations are things that displace you in the phase space, things that rotate you in the phase space, and also these squeezing operations that sort of contract you in one axis and stretch you out in the other, and I didn't try to draw that here. And if you ask, well, what does this correspond to on the quantum side? It's just the Wigner representations of the unitaries that are associated with these quadratic Hamiltonians. So for example, take these phase-space displacements. There's a unitary in quantum theory that corresponds to translating by x-naught and translating momentum by p-naught. P hat is the generator of translations. X hat is the generator of translations and momentum. So this is the unitary that would translate me by x naught and p naught. If I write it out as an adjoint representation acting on density operators, it's just this. That's a particular completely positive map, just a unitary one. And so I can say, what does the Wigner representation of that map look like? That's what I showed you in an earlier slide, that for any CP map, it has a Wigner representation. You work it out, and it's exactly just take the Wigner representation of rho, evaluate it at x plus x naught and p plus p naught gives me the Wigner representation for rho prime. So I can really think of it in this picture as just take the distribution, shift it over. That's the new distribution of your final state. And it's the same with the rotations and the squeezing. You can think of this as a covariance property, right? That the transformations on the quantum state get represented in the Wigner representation as the corresponding transformation on the phase space, whether it be a rotation, squeezing, or translation. So that's quite nice. What about the measurements? Well, again, you can define them as follows. You can say, only allow those measurements that don't violate that restriction that we started with. So if you allowed a measurement that would give you too much information, for instance, about position and momentum, then at the end of the day, you get a distribution that violated the restriction. And if you work it out, you find that your measurements are also restricted. So for instance, you could do a measurement that tells you what the position was, right? So I've tried to draw a bunch of these things that are delta functions along x and uniform along p. So I could carve up the phase space into these lines and say, which line am I in? That would teach me what the position of the particle was, and it would teach me nothing about the momentum. Or I could carve it up along the momentum lines. It would teach me everything about momentum, nothing about position. But there are also measurements that teach me a little bit about position and a little bit about momentum, but never too much. I can't learn both. So I could have a set of these coherent distributions covering the phase space. And you note that you find that they are the Wigner representations of the quantum measurements that are in this Gaussian fragment of quantum theory. Okay, I've said only stuff about one particle. So what about two particles, three particles, or more? So there's an uncertainty principle that you don't read about in your textbooks, which covers the case of any number of particles. But it would take me quite a long time to explain exactly how that works. So instead, I'm going to take a different route. I'm just going to say, suppose you allow all the products of valid states of knowledge, right? So we know for system one, you know, what are the valid states of knowledge according to our theory, and you know for system two, what are the valid states of knowledge there. So I could just say that's also a valid state of knowledge of the composite, just having valid knowledge of each of the components. So start there, and then say, allow any canonical transformation with quadratic Hamiltonian on the pair of those systems. And if you do that, well, you can prove it corresponds to satisfying this generalized uncertainty principle that I'm not going to tell you about. But let's just use this definition so we can get some idea how it works. If you do that, then you can learn about some new states of knowledge that you can have on the composite, which aren't of the product form, because some of these transformations will mix coordinates having to do with one system into global coordinates. So for example, if I have two systems, I'll call them A and B. X, A, and P, A are the position momentum of A, and X, B, and P, B are the position momentum of B. Then here's a valid canonical transformation that's generated by a quadratic Hamiltonian. XA goes to the difference of the two coordinates, PA goes to the difference of the two momenta, XB and PB go to the sums of the coordinates and the momenta. If you wanted to verify that this was a valid canonical transformation, you could verify that the Poisson brackets of these four variables are all preserved. So we're going to get to the Poisson bracket in a moment, but the Poisson bracket of XA and PA is one. They're canonically conjugate. These guys are also canonically conjugate. These guys are canonically conjugate with one another, so are these. Whereas the Poisson bracket with any of this pair, with any of this pair, is zero, and similarly for any of this pair and any of this pair. So if you consider that transformation, and suppose you start with one of these valid product states of knowledge. So let's say, for example, you know the position of particle A, and you know the momentum of particle B. That's one example of a product distribution. So then if you apply this map, at the end of the day, what you know is the relative position of the two particles and the sums of their momenta, because the position of A has been mapped into the relative position and the momentum B has been mapped into the sum of the momenta. And so I could write that as follows. The joint distribution on the four coordinates is one which is a delta function where xA minus xB takes the value little a. It's just the value that I presumed over here. And a delta distribution where the sum of the momenta has the value B. And this is precisely the Wigner representation of the original Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state. If you look at the EPR paper, you'll find that they aren't talking about spin systems or qubits. They're talking about two particles. And they say, let's imagine that the original quantum state is the joint eigenstate of the difference in the position operators and the sum of the momentum operators. And so it's infinitely squeezed in those two coordinates and infinitely spread out in the other two, xA plus xB and pA minus pB. And so this is exactly the distribution that corresponds under this isomorphism to the EPR state. And it's a state where you know everything about the relationship between these two particles and nothing about their individual properties. So there's a lot more that there are many ways of knowing about a pair of particles in addition to just having this kind of product distribution. And this is an example. Okay, so I'm going to need to, I want to say a little bit more about what kinds of variables you can jointly know, because it'll be useful for the discrete theories. So far I've defined everything in terms of this uncertainty principle, but there's another way of characterizing some of these states of knowledge, which is to characterize which sets of variables you can jointly have knowledge of. So it turns out that it's precisely the ones that are going to commute relative to the Poisson bracket. Okay, let me remind you how the Poisson bracket works. So configuration space is just the real line. Phase space is just the real squared. I'm going to denote that by M. And now I can define functionals on the phase space, which are just maps from the phase space to real numbers. And, you know, for example, capital X here is going to be the functional that picks out the position of this phase space point M. Capital P will be the functional that picks out the point on the momentum axis of this phase space point M. And so if you give me any two functionals, capital F and capital G over the phase space, their Poisson bracket is defined this way. I take derivatives with respect to the position and the momentum functionals, df dx, dg dp. I subtract df dp, dg dx. I evaluate it at M. That's the functional defined by the Poisson bracket. Now if I move to multiple particles, it's exactly the same thing. I have functionals for the ith guy, position and the momentum of the ith guy. And then the Poisson bracket is just the sum for each of the particles. I suppose I could say that the I could range not only over the particles, but over various different coordinates of a single particle, like the x, y, and z coordinates. OK, so for example, if I say what corresponds to a canonically conjugate pair of functionals, that's just the case where the Poisson bracket's 1. So particle 1, x1, and p1 are conjugate, right? That's an example of a pair whose Poisson bracket is 1, because if I put x and p in here, I get a 1, and here I get a 0, so that's a just uniform function 1 over the phase space. But also things like x1 plus x2, p1 plus p2, those are conjugate. They have the same, they also have a Poisson bracket of 1. But if I ask about the cases of variables that Poisson commute, I get, for example, that the position of the first particle and the position of the second, they commute. The position of the first and the momentum of the second, they commute. In fact, any variable of the first system and any variable of the second system commute with one another. But similarly, there's these interesting cases of global variables like x1 minus x2 and p1 plus p2. That's the case we saw a couple of slides ago. They also commute. You know, that example I showed you, you know, you can come to know these both of these values at the same time. You know, I can come to know the position of the first particle and momentum of the second at the same time, but I can also come to know the relative position, the sum of the momenta at the same time. And what you can show is that uncertainty relation constraint implies that you can know any set of variables as long as they Poisson commute. Canonical transformations preserve the Poisson bracket, so Any canonical transformation of a set of variables that Poisson commute, also Poisson commute. So I've almost completed telling you everything you need to know. I didn't mention what the Wigner representation for a pair or more number of systems are, but it's just take the phase point operators for each one of them, take their tensor product. Turns out that forms a basis of the operator space for the pair of systems. So this is the Wigner representation for a state on a pair of systems. and you can show that, again, this restricted theory I showed you corresponds to the Wigner representations of all the Gaussian quantum states for some pair of systems or for some triple or any number. So here's the bottom line. Again, this is just kind of a quick survey of how it works. But the idea is you can show that Gaussian quantum mechanics, which corresponds to having the states with Gaussian Wigner representations, the measurements that have Gaussian Wigner representations and the transformations that preserve this Gaussianity property, all of that is precisely equal in its predictions to this epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics theory I defined for you. And if I take the Wigner representation of that theory, then it looks exactly like the theory that I was defining. So let me show you what some phenomena look like in this theory. according to this model. So take the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect. So remember, that's where the situation where I have an entangled pair of systems, and then what choice of basis to measure on this system determines how I collapse the quantum state of the distant system. And if you take the view that the quantum state describes reality, then my choice of what to measure over here is determine which set of quantum states, and therefore which set of realities, this distant system collapses to. And so my choice here can influence the distant reality. In these sorts of psi epistemic models, it's just your knowledge of the distant reality that changes. So assume that you've got this original EPR state on systems A and B. So in this model, that just corresponds to knowing that the relative position is zero and the sum of the momenta is zero. So just you know the values of these two variables. And so if you ask, what do I know about variable B on its own? The answer is nothing, right? Because if I worked out the marginal over QBPB, I'd find it's uniform for both. I just draw that as a flat distribution over those guys. So then I come along, I measure the position of particle A, and I find it's Q naught. Well, then I can reason as follows, that you know, initially, I knew that whatever the position of QA was, QB has exactly the same position. So I've just learned that this guy had position Q naught. Well, then I know that B had position Q naught as well. So my knowledge of system B gets updated to this delta distribution at Q naught. I still know nothing about the momentum of B. So in this picture, measuring the position of A, leads me to update my knowledge to these distributions that are the analogs of position eigenstates, right? But nothing's, okay, well, let's move on. So suppose instead that I measure the momentum of particle A and find P naught. Again, that initial distribution was perfectly correlated, happened to be anti-correlated, but I can perfectly infer the momentum of B given the momentum of A. So I can update my knowledge of the momentum of B to some delta distribution, just the negative of P naught. And I still know nothing about Q. So what you can imagine is that all along, the system on the right-hand side here was in some ontic state right here in the phase space. I didn't know it was there. And all that changes as I update as I do my measurement here is my knowledge. I get closer to knowing exactly where it is. I can resolve my uncertainty about either position or momentum, but not both. Because the restriction says you can't learn both these things. I can only ever choose to resolve it one way. So what's nice about this is that you don't require any spooky action at a distance. You just say, no, the collapse of the quantum state is a kind of Bayesian conditioning. I'm just changing my knowledge because all the quantum state represents in this sort of model is knowledge of reality and not reality itself. So questions about that? Clear? Good. Let's consider another example. Take the collapse rule when you measure a system directly. So the case we just considered was I'm updating my knowledge of a system over here by virtue of making measurements on another system that was entangled with it. But the more common situation is I do a measurement directly on a system and I update the quantum state that I assigned to that system. And usually we use this von Neumann-Luders collapse rule, which says the system goes into an eigenstate of the observable that I measured corresponding to the eigenvalue that I got. How does that look in this approach? So imagine you have a system B and you're measuring its position. So I'll call that QB. Q is going to be a classical variable that encodes the outcome of your measurement. B prime is going to be the version of the system after when it comes out of the measurement device, so the post measurement version of the system. Good, and again, just like in the last slide, this dashed line means that there could be a common cause acting on these guys. So suppose you do that, and suppose, to be concrete, that you start out knowing that B, you start out knowing its momentum. So that would correspond to it starting out in a momentum eigenstate quantum mechanically. If you measure the position when it starts out in a momentum eigenstate, you expect to get a random outcome and to collapse it to the position eigenstate. So first thing to note is that in a classical theory, if I started out knowing its momentum, and if I just measured its position, and the way I represented that measurement was just as a kind of passive observation, then I would come to know everything, because I knew its momentum, I've just passively learnt its position, so now both bits of knowledge are still relevant, and I know everything. I have a delta function in the phase space. And that, of course, would violate this restriction that we started with. And so we can infer that measurements don't work like that in this theory. that I can't passively measure position. And in fact, you can justify that claim by doing a model of this whole thing. So suppose I model the measurement device as a coupling between my system and a probe system, which I'm going to call A. And I'll just use the standard von Neumann coupling. Okay, so this is the one that you see in the textbooks. You say, suppose I couple the system to my probe via this PQ coupling. So this is classical now. So I'm saying this is the classical Hamiltonian that I have to add in. And the way to interpret it is P classically is the generator of translations. So you should think of this as I translate the probe system by an amount proportional to the original position of the system I'm measuring. It works similarly in quantum theory, that you want to sort of translate your probe, then measure how far your probe has been translated, and then infer the position of the system from that. But here, everything's classical. So we're going to imagine that we're going to measure the position of the system in this fashion, and we're going to, again, assume that the system starts out such that we know its momentum and know nothing of its position. You know, that's why we're measuring its position, because we want to learn it. Well, if you're going to measure how much the probe gets translated in order to infer the position of system B, then you'd better know where the probe started out, right? If you're going to try to figure out how far did it move, there's no point starting out knowing nothing about the position of the probe, because then you won't be able to figure out how far it's been translated. So you must start out with the probe prepared in this state of knowledge, where you know its position, but you don't know its momentum, just so that the measurement's going to work. Remember, you can't know both its position and its momentum, so you have to grant that you know nothing about its momentum. Okay, and now here's the interesting thing, that this coupling here not only translates the probe by an amount that depends on the initial position of the system, but it goes the other way as well. Q in classical mechanics is the generator of translations of momentum. So I can also think of this coupling as the system B has its momentum translated by an amount that depends on the initial momentum of system A. But the initial momentum of system A is totally unknown. Therefore, the momentum of system B gets translated by an amount that is totally unknown. So if this is all I do, if I just couple these guys together, then this guy, I start out knowing his momentum, but I now translate it by an unknown amount. So I lose all knowledge of momentum. Okay, but that's not any kind of objective indeterminism in this model. It's just my uncertainty about the probe has infected my certainty about the system, and now I have uncertainty about the system as well. But at the end of the day, I come along and I measure the position of the probe, and so I can learn how much the probe has translated relative to its initial position. And because I know this is the coupling, that teaches me what the position of this guy must have been initially. And I know its position hasn't changed. So in the end, I can say, ah, yes, I do know its position. But I still know nothing about its momentum, because its momentum has been translated by an unknown amount. And so this looks exactly like what we would see in quantum mechanics, that I start in a momentum eigenstate, I measure position, I collapse to a position eigenstate. But there's no indeterminism here. The uncertainty is all just epistemic. It has to do with not knowing certain initial properties of the probe system. And I've appealed to an action-reaction principle, that every attempt to make properties of the particle influence the probe always goes along with properties of the probe influencing properties of the particle, which is why that my uncertainty of the particle, that's why I generate uncertainty in the momentum of the particle. Okay, so the bottom line is that if you think about the collapse rule in these sorts of models, that updating from a momentum eigenstate to a position eigenstate type thing can be broken up into two steps. The first is this disturbance of the momentum by an unknown amount, followed by a Bayesian conditioning, where I learn what the position of the particle was. So that's how I get that overall effect. Okay, so in the last 15 minutes, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this works for these discrete systems. I introduced these continuous variable systems first because they're a bit more familiar to most physicists. And so, you know, the analogy with the uncertainty principle, I think, makes it a bit clearer what's going on. Things get a bit more abstract in this case. All right. So this is what particle mechanics looked like. I had a configuration space, a phase space, functionals over the phase space and a Poisson bracket. So I'm going to do the same thing for this theory of bits. This is, you know, again, physicists don't usually talk about bits, but I could, if I wanted to, say, yeah, they have a configuration space. It's Z2, just the elements 0 and 1. And if I have n of these bits, then it's Z2 to the n. That's the configuration space. And similarly, you can introduce a phase space where all your momenta have values in Z2 as well. So it's an abstract notion of a phase space. It's discrete. I can only have two possible positions and two possible momenta for each particle, always at the value 0 and 1. And then the functionals are exactly analogous, that they're maps from this discrete phase space into Z2, just 0 or 1. So for example, the position of the kth bit is just, you know, the 0 or 1 value along the kth axis of this phase space vector m, similarly with the momentum for the kth bit. And you can define a Poisson bracket. You don't have derivatives anymore, because everything is discrete. But you can do a sort of finite difference where I shift the phase space vector in the xi-th direction by one unit, and I subtract off the value at the original point in phase space. Similarly with g, so here I'm shifting in position, here I'm shifting in momentum, and in the other turn I'm shifting in momentum, shifting in position. So you get a nice analog of the continuous variable theory by doing it this way. And then you can proceed exactly analogously. You can just say, my restriction is that an observer can only have knowledge of the values of some set of canonical variables that commute relative to this discrete Poisson bracket. Just like we saw in the continuous variable case, those are the only sets of variables you can know at the same time. It'll be the same thing here. And the observer has to be maximally ignorant otherwise. So that's like the maximum entropy constraint. That, you know, once you've told me these are the variables you know, you don't know anything else. So you just have uniform distributions over the other axes. All right, so what does it look like for a single bit? So its phase space is just these four possibilities. Two possible positions, two possible momenta. If you ask what are the possible canonical variables, the functionals on this phase space, there's only three of them. Well, you know, modulo trivial changes like adding one to them, but there's the position functional, the momentum functional, and x plus p. They all have this form, ax plus bp. I'm leaving out the cases where I just sum over some constant c. But a and b are elements of Z2. So none of them Poisson commute with each other, right? They're all canonically conjugate. So I can only ever know one of these variables at a given time. And if I say that x is the variable that's known, then there's only two possible states of knowledge. I can know that x has the value 0. I can know that x has the value 1. But then I don't know anything about p, because I have maximum ignorance otherwise. So these blue, just think of this as a probability distribution, which is 0 in the white squares and a half in the blue squares. So I'm just saying it's a uniform distribution over those guys or those guys. If p is known, then I know nothing about position, but I know that p is 0 or p is 1. And if x plus p is known, then it corresponds to these diagonals. So this would be the case where x plus p is known to be 0. So then either they both have value 0, or they both have value 1. And maybe I didn't say it explicitly, but you know, addition here, because we're in Z2, addition is always modulo 2. So if I ask, you know, what pair of values for x and p solve the equation x plus p equal to 0, it's 0, 0, and 1, 1, because 1 plus 1 is 0 in Z2 arithmetic. So these are the states of knowledge corresponding to knowing this guy. And of course, you could know nothing. You could know none of these variables, in which case it's just a uniform distribution over all four. So these are very much like what we saw before. These are the position eigenstates, the momentum eigenstates, the ones that are rotated in the phase space relative to position momentum eigenstates. But it's all in this discrete setting now. And it turns out that these are precisely analogous to eigenstates of polyoperators for a qubit. So these are analogous to the 0 and 1 eigenstates, plus and minus eigenstates, defined in the usual way, and the what I'll call the plus I and minus I eigenstates, like this. So in another language, you know, this is the Z polyoperator eigenstates, X polyoperator eigenstates, Y polyoperator eigenstates. And this would correspond to the completely mixed state for the qubit. Okay, so let me first observe some analogies. So you might be familiar with the fact that for a qubit, there's lots of different pure state ensembles that mix to the complete mixed state. So whether I take the Z eigenstates or the X eigenstates and mix them together, these are many ways of writing out the complete mixed state. So that corresponds here to the fact that if I tell you my state of knowledge is either this or this with equal likelihood, well, then it's just, you can work it out to be the uniform distribution. But if I tell you I know this or I know this with equal likelihood, that also averages out to the uniform distribution. So the key here is that because the pure quantum states are being represented not by delta distributions in the phase space, not by states of complete knowledge, but by states of incomplete knowledge, I now have a very easy way of taking a representation of a mixed state and decomposing it in many different ways into states of incomplete knowledge, right? It comes out as a very natural possibility in this sort of approach. Whereas if these were all six distinct states of reality, then it's very, then you could say it's strange that a mixture of these two realities is operationally totally indistinguishable from a mixture of these two realities. Why is it that no measurement could tell the difference between this set and this set? Whereas here, I would say, well, the reason that this mixture and this mixture are not distinguishable is because they both correspond to sampling at the end of the day from exactly the same distribution. So, you know, a quarter of the time, the physical state is this, 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 or this in both cases. And that's why nothing you can do can tell them apart. Good. So if you plot out what these states of knowledge that are allowed in this theory look like, so here I've tried to draw a tetrahedron where the vertices would be these point distributions on one of the four physical states. The states of maximal knowledge we've been talking about lie halfway along each of the edges of that tetrahedron. So it basically forms kind of the vertices of an octahedron embedded in that tetrahedron. I think this picture is easier to make sense of than the one I drew. So these are the valid states of knowledge for the system, and they're precisely the poles of the Bloch sphere and the center of the Bloch sphere, right? So that's the part of quantum theory that you can reproduce, just these six pure states and that one mixed state. The rest of it's not part of the theory. But it contains interesting measurements. So if you ask what are the valid measurements, the ones that are allowed under the restriction on knowledge, you can measure position, which means you ask, is the x equal to 0 or is it x equal to 1? So I've just drawn in different colors the different regions of phase spaces that you would discriminate in this measurement. Similarly with a measurement of the discrete momentum or a measurement of x plus p. And they have, in terms of the statistics of outcomes of these measurements, they look just like what you would see in the stabilizer formalism for a qubit. So they're just like the z, x, and y eigenstate measurements. So for instance, if I have an operational experiment where I'm preparing the z up eigenstate and then measuring the x poly operator, in this model it says, I am sampling the physical state of the system from its four possible physical states with this distribution. So half the time it's going to be here, half the time it's going to be there. And then I'm asking the question, is it over on the left or is it over on the right? And so what I expect to see is that, you know, because it's equally likely to be here or here, half the time I get the red outcome and half the time I get the green outcome, just as quantum theory predicts we should see. But now, in this model, it's not indeterministic. It depends precisely on the properties of the particle that are coming out of this device. And it's just that I have some uncertainty about those properties, and that's why the outcome is not determinate. Again, you can sort of ask, well, what about, we've talked about the preparations, the measurements, what about the transformations? And so it's very similar. You have a notion of canonical transformations relative to this discrete phase space. They preserve this discrete Poisson bracket that I defined. And it turns out that all 24 of the permutations of your four ontic states correspond to valid canonical transformations. They all preserve this Poisson bracket. So I can just draw them. Here's some samples. I can draw them like this. There's 24 of them in all. And now take a look at this. If I say, well, what does a given transformation of the ontic states imply for how my knowledge changes, right? So if I tell you, here's a particular three cycle. It takes this ontic state to this one to this one, and this one to this one. What does it do to the epistemic state? So if I don't know whether the ontic state is here or here, I just apply this transformation. Well, if it's here, it's going to stay there. And if it was in the top right-hand corner, it's going to move down. So if this is what I start out knowing, at the end of that transformation, this is what I know. And if this is what I start out knowing, it moves over to here, and it corresponds to a rotation in this block sphere picture. And similarly, these three guys undergo a three cycle. So this ontic transformation ends up being represented as a deterministic transformation over your probability distributions, much like a unitary in quantum theory is represented by a rotation on the block sphere. If you look at a pair of two cycles, this guy and this guy, it ends up looking like this sort of transformation where these two probability distributions are fixed. Note that no ontic state is left unchanged, but this epistemic state maps to itself because the ontic states here just get swapped. So in quantum theory, you might have thought, you know, if you thought quantum states were real, that a unitary that leaves the quantum state invariant doesn't change reality at all, but here it does. There's some change to the reality, but my knowledge of reality is unchanged. Okay, so that's another important distinction. This is what a single two cycle looks like in the picture, and a four cycle looks like this. And if I draw them all, here's all 24 of them. And they look a lot like, if you ask in the stabilizer formalism, what are all the unitaries that take eigenstates of Pauli operators to eigenstates of Pauli operators? And the answer is there's 24 of them, and there you can map them on isomorphically to these guys, except these guys are not precisely those transformations because these guys are actually the symmetries of tetrahedron under rotations and reflections, whereas the 24 unitaries in the stabilizer formalism are just rotations. There's no reflections. That would be an anti-unitary. So if I take all these guys and I drop the single arrow so that they become rotations again, and I take these guys and I add an arrow where it's missing, like for these guys along the diagonal, then these guys become rotations. So in a sense, all I have to do is transfer one of these arrows into here, and I get exactly the quantum unitaries. Okay, so it's different. It's not quite the quantum theory for a qubit, and you start to see it when you start looking at the transformations. But it's very close. I think I'm going to skip this. You can take a look at it in the copies of these slides. It's just an argument that you have a notion of coherent superposition if you want it. And let me just try to end by saying, okay, something about composite systems. If I have a pair of these guys, then the variables look like these kinds of combinations. I have to find a way of representing this diagrammatically, which is a bit tricky because now we're talking about a four-dimensional discrete phase space, and it's hard to draw pictures in 4D. So what I do is I take the 2x2 blocks and I just write it on a line, and then a pair of systems, x1, p1, x2, p2, end up just being a two-dimensional plot. If you do that, then you find that you can know, for example, like our old example, the position of the first guy, the momentum of the second guy. So I know, say, the position of the first guy is 0. I know nothing about the momentum of the first guy. And I know nothing about either coordinate of the second guy. Over here, I know that the momentum of the second guy is 0. So that's these two columns. But I know nothing about the position, so whether I'm here or here. And I know nothing about the first guy. But of course, I can know both of those things because they Poisson commute. X1 and P2 Poisson commute. I can know them jointly. So if I combine those two states of knowledge, I get this state of knowledge here. And that's just a product distribution. And it's just the analog of 0 tensor plus. I know that, quantumly, I would know this guy's in a Z eigenstate, this guy's in an X eigenstate. That's how this model represents that state of knowledge. But I can also know some joint properties, like X1 plus X2 and P1 plus P2 commute. Turns out, because this is arithmetic modulo 2, P1 plus P2 and P1 minus P2 are actually the same thing, because minus 1 is equal to plus 1 in arithmetic modulo 2. So this is just like the EPR situation, where you know the relative position and the sum of the momenta. So this is what it looks like if you work out, the case where x1 plus x2 is equal to 0, it corresponds to knowing that you're somewhere here or here. P1 plus P2 corresponds to knowing that you're on one of those checkerboard. And knowing both jointly corresponds to having one of these four guys. So this is a state of knowledge where you know that the position momentum of the first guy are both 0 and the position momentum of the second guy are both 0. Or x1 is equal to 0, p1 is equal to 1, and x2 is equal to 0, p2 is equal to 1 here. So you know that they're in exactly the same ontic state, but you just don't know what it is. So the marginals of this distribution are uniform on both sides. And that's, again, precisely analogous to this kind of quantum state. The marginals are the completely mixed state. You can't predict anything about the outcomes on them. But if I do any measurement on the first system, I can infer what the outcome of the corresponding measurement on the second system would be. So in this state, if I measure, say, the 0-1 basis on the first system, I learn what outcome I would get for the 0-1 basis measurement on the second system. And it's the same here, that if I measure, I resolve my uncertainty about x1, I say, is it here in 0 or 1? Let's say I find it 0. So probability 0 gets assigned to everything here. And I learn that this guy must also be 0, because he's in one of these two slots. All right, so let me wrap up. Measurements look similar. It's just, you know, partitionings of this space into these kinds of bases. You can work out all the valid transformations that are canonical in this approach and preserve this restriction. And you can work out that steering and the collapse rule are exactly as we saw them before. I've gone a bit over time, so I think I'm going to skip explaining teleportation and no cloning, but you can always ask me afterwards if you're interested.
But there is a limit to what you can do, right, in this framework?
Sure, yeah. It's
as we said in the, we only had like 7 possible states in the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so yeah, in the next few lectures, I'm going to talk about Bell's theorem, the Cauchy-Specker theorem, contextuality, and those are going to be the best way to understand what's missing in these sorts of models. So the claim is that this gets a small part relative to the space of all states and measurements and stuff, but in terms of the space of phenomena, you say, well, here's a bunch of distinctively quantum phenomena, the collapse rule, the EPR effect, teleportation, no cloning, the fact that I get indeterministic outcomes, the fact that there are, you know, there's non-commutativity, the order in which I do measurements matters. All those things exist here, and you can explain how it works.
Do we get quantum speed up
of quantum
in computing? Quantum
so yeah, if the exponential speed ups that we believe exist, mm-hmm. so things like Shor's algorithm. You can show that those don't exist in these models because you can simulate classically any such circuit. But there's also been recent results that show that the quantum speedup is related to the contextuality of quantum theory, which I'm going to talk about in the next few lectures. So if you know, understand that connection, you would certainly not expect to see that there. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
In the beginning, you had the... For the classical distributions, you get the uncertainty principle restriction, which makes sense. But then there was also the maximal entropy restriction.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a physical justification for that, or is that just there to make it match with Gaussian?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, we realized. You know, this is some of my research with collaborators. We realized that if you add in the maximum entropy, then you get this precise match, and that was the only real justification we had for it. And I can't say anything more than that. It's you would certainly get a different kind of theory if you allowed in the ones that just had the second order moments satisfying that uncertainty principle and didn't demand the maximum entropy.
I have a second question about Bell's inequality, but are you going to be talking about that next time anyway?
Or, yes.
Yeah, okay. Then
I'll be talking about Bell's inequality. You're going to see a bit more of this kind of stuff in tutorial, I think, tomorrow? Are you having tomorrow this stuff? I think so.